Good morning. For millions of Americans, including myself, the musical Hamilton is an obsession. Based on Ron Chernow's 2004 biography of Alexander Hamilton, our first Secretary of Treasury, the musical has won a Grammy, 11 Tony Awards, and a Pulitzer Prize. With men and women of color in all the leading roles, we are given a glimpse of our nation now and as it was in the 18th century. The discourse and music of our multicultural, pluralistic present, hip-hop, rap, R&B, jazz, musical theater, and pop, provides us with a lens on the past, prompting us to explore the complexities and contradictions of the founding fathers and mothers in ways that reveal much about today. As all works of historical fiction, it is influenced by the time in which it was written as much as the time in which it is set. Our service is not about Alexander Hamilton, the founding father without a father. It's about us. It's about now. But in the now, we see Alexander Hamilton's life work. And in Hamilton's life, we see traces of our own. His work continues to shape how America functions each and every day, from the careful balance of power within the three branches of government spelled out in our Constitution to our monetary systems. During the service today, just a few days away from the peaceful transition of power for which this nation is known, what can Hamilton the musical, Hamilton the man, and the earliest days of our republic tell us? The first song you are going to hear is called Alexander Hamilton. It opens the show and sets the stage. As you listen, think about the connections you make between Hamilton and yourself, between his world and ours. Alexander Hamilton, another immigrant coming up from the bottom. No wall kept Hamilton from coming to the colonies. The American dream, at least as we have fashioned it, tells us that with an education and a willingness to work hard, you can get ahead. Through adversity, you can triumph. Each of us has our own immigrant history, recent or distant, known or unknown, that shapes our experience of America and where we and our families fit into its narrative. America loves improbable stories, like those of Alexander Hamilton and Barack Hussein Obama, in part because the American dream has not always worked for everyone. Recognizing his exceptional intellectual and verbal gifts, Hamilton's community in St. Croix paid for his education in America. He attended King's College, now Columbia University, on the eve of the Revolution. In 1775, Hamilton joined the New York militia and went on to serve as George Washington's aide-de-camp. After the war, Hamilton, a vocal critic of the Articles of Confederation and an advocate of a strong central government, helped establish and then participated in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He wrote 51 of the 85 Federalist Papers, explaining the Constitution's content and advocating for its ratification. Indeed, he rewrote the game. Many of us were waiting to see what the Hamilton electors would do in December. This week, we've been talking a lot about the Emoluments Clause of Article 1, Section 9, as it relates to the president-elect and his relationship with Russia. Barack Obama's presidency has been that of a strong federal government. We are on edge about the repeal of landmark federal legislation such as the Affordable Care Act. We are all exhausted from a coarse and vitriolic presidential campaign and hope that this discourse is not the new normal. When Washington was elected president, he asked Hamilton to serve as Treasury Secretary and Jefferson as Secretary of State. In this next song, Cabinet Battle Number 1. We'll hear about Hamilton's efforts to establish our monetary systems and Jefferson's resistance via a rap battle. Who should be responsible for federal debt? What constitutes too much? When is debt a good thing? States' rights versus federal rights. Regionalism. Unwieldy, dense, lengthy legislation. Soldiers versus parlor generals. Taxes. Making money by moving money around. The financial legacy of slavery. Congress held hostage. Congress rejecting one plan without having another. Sound familiar? Hamilton's plan was approved, and we're living it. George Washington served 2 4-year terms and then left office. The next song, One Last Time, is about that decision. After I graduated college, I worked for 4 years at the U.S. House of Representatives. I watched President Clinton take the oath of office, and my most powerful memory of that day was watching the helicopter that carried the first President Bush rise up from the other side of the Capitol building and fly over the Mall. Thousands and thousands of us looked up, and instinctively, we waved. Maybe some of you were there, or maybe some of you experienced a similar moment in one of President Obama's inaugurations. There's a strength in stepping away from power. President Obama, while not heading home yet, is stepping down. Throughout this month, he's been teaching us how to say goodbye, and we have to learn how to live without him in the Oval Office. It is neither easy nor simple. We don't know what lies ahead. We are in unprecedented times. But on some level, we live and have always lived in unprecedented times. When Obama first became president, he did not know how the story of his presidency would end. When America was losing 500,000 jobs a month, he had no idea that his efforts would really lead to the financial recovery that we now enjoy. He had no idea if his plan to provide universal access to healthcare would work, and he made mistakes. When George Washington assumed the presidency, he had no idea how his presidency would end. He was unsure whether or not the government could last more than 20 years. Abraham Lincoln had no idea whether he could reunite the states, and whether the Emancipation Proclamation, enacted in the midst of the Civil War, would actually free enslaved African Americans. Harriet Tubman never knew if the next trip on the Underground Railroad would be her last, but she went back again and again. Susan B. Anthony did not know when women would earn the vote, but that didn't stop her. Martin Luther King Jr. did not know if he would live to see actual racial and economic justice. But that did not stop him from working towards his beloved community every day. John Lewis didn't know what was going to happen each time he went on a freedom ride, but he kept getting back on the bus. And when men and women arrived for a drink at the Stonewall Inn on Saturday, June 28, 1969, they didn't know that they were going to be the catalyst for a movement. Since November 9th, my own deep pain and pervasive sadness has revealed to me how much I love my country. And perhaps that's how you feel too. Because this is my country, and it's your country, and it belongs to all of us and none of us at the same time. Ideally, it outlasts all of us. We are tasked with tending to it, as the framers intended. The strength of the Constitution is its clarity and its flexibility in a world our founding fathers and mothers could not have imagined. In response to the election, I've been thinking a lot about the ways in which Obama's presidency maybe allowed me to take a free pass of sorts. I keep asking myself, what have I done over the past 8 years to foster democracy? How have I been a leader and an activist? Has it been a little too easy for me, having Obama in the Oval Office? Have I counted on him too much? Have I looked to the federal government to take action too often? And I've been thinking a lot, too, about if we are straight and white and middle class, are we only now beginning to understand in some small sense the vulnerability that our friends and neighbors and family of color have always felt, what the LGBTQ community has always felt? And what about journalists? How did their treatment of our president-elect during the campaign contribute to his election? How did ratings wars, the proliferation of news organizations and outlets, fake news, news as infotainment, and the complex new finances of print and digital journalism shape coverage? How will the Fourth Estate better police itself and hold itself to higher standards so that we can be a better informed citizenry? And how do we hold it accountable? And what about the private sector? With the federal government taking a stance on climate change, civil rights, and universal access to health care, was industry allowed to lay low? Will corporate America recognize out of self-interest that there is money to be made in the green economy and forge forward when the government does not? Without Obama in the White House, will corporate America pay more lip service to diversity as an asset and work to shape education, racial justice, civil rights, and health care at the local and regional level? If not, how do we hold them accountable? In the 1963 March on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of the fierce urgency of now. What are we going to do for our community and our country? For the boys and girls who look up to us and depend on us? What are we as everyday citizens and Unitarian Universalists going to do? What can we learn from those of you who remember the 1960s, who lived it? In turn, what can our young people teach us about global citizenship? The quest for justice and civil rights does not happen in a linear fashion, as President Obama reminded us this week. And throughout the musical Hamilton, we hear the refrain, "History has its eyes on you." History has its eyes on us. What would Alexander Hamilton say to us right now? If Washington, Tubman, and MLK have their eyes on us, what do they see? And do we make them proud? What will people say about us 10, 50, and 100 years from now? What did we do in this moment, in the fierce urgency of now? What did we do when we didn't know how our story was going to end? This final song from Hamilton, "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story," concludes the musical. Washington opens the song. We hear from Jefferson and Madison, Hamilton's political rivals, Hamilton's sister-in-law, Angelica Church, and his wife, Eliza, who outlived him by 50 years.